Last time, I talked a bit about the transformation of the international system in 1871 with the unification of Germany. Really, it was the events of the period from 1862 to 1871 that transformed the system. Bismarck comes to power in Prussia in 1862. You have three wars, the war against Denmark in 1864, the war against Austria in 1866, and then the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-1871. And as a result of that policy, as a result of those conflicts, the system changes. Prussia in 1862 was the weakest of the five great powers. By 1871, the German Empire, which is in many ways an enlarged Prussia, certainly dominated by Prussia, is the strongest of the five great powers. In 1862, Central Europe in geopolitical terms was something of a vacuum. Certainly the ability of the Germanic powers to act as a unit had been compromised by the struggle between Austria and Prussia for predominance in Germany. And that had strengthened the position of the wing powers of Russia in the east and of Britain and France in the west. I have to say, a little late, I had to go to the room next door to get the piece of chocolate. He just delivers it. Okay, that's different. Now you have not just a very strong German Empire, but Austria accepts the new situation, in large part because of internal changes that had taken place in the Austrian monarchy as a result of Austria's defeat, first in Italy and then in Germany. This is the famous compromise, the German word is Ausgleich, in Austria in 1867, where the Austrian monarchy is divided into two parts. As a matter of fact, the name of the country changes. It becomes Austria-Hungary, or the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. Because a big chunk, essentially the eastern half of the Habsburg monarchy, is changed into a Hungarian state, in a sense. It remains part of the monarchy, but it has very broad measures of internal autonomy. And this is not a state that's composed of ethnic Hungarians, let's say Magyars, people of Hungarian nationality, Hungarian language, and so on. The Hungarians are the ruling class in the Hungarian half of the Habsburg monarchy, and they rule over a very large number of Slavs. Now, why is this important? Because the Hungarians have the Magyars, the rulers of Hungary, have a very strong interest in the maintenance of the status quo. They can't take in more Slavs in Austria-Hungary for fear of affecting the political balance in that country. They take in, you know, their whole power in Hungary, and therefore in the Austro-Hungarian monarchy as a whole, and therefore in Europe as a whole, depends on the status quo. It depends on their ability to control the Hungarian half of the monarchy. It depends on the weight that the Hungarian half of the monarchy carries in the Habsburg monarchy as a whole, and that gives them a certain a power in Europe as a whole. A series of levers. They don't want to challenge the verdict of 1871, because even if such a policy were successful, it would break the equilibrium within Austria-Hungary. It would bring too many more Germans in. Right? Same point about not challenging the status quo in Italy. It's because of this internal political change, this structural reform of the Austrian monarchy in 1867, that Austria accepts the verdict of 1871, accepts, you know, the new status quo of a unified Germany under Prussian auspices, right? And it's committed to the maintenance of the status quo, as a matter of fact, for friendship with the new German state. Okay. Source of strength for the new German state. And the new German state, the state of created by Bismarck, is also a status quo power. Bismarck says over and over again, no more territorial conquests. We've reached the limit, right? Maybe we've even gone too far. Certain misgivings about bringing so many Frenchmen into our house who don't want to be there. You don't want to go any further. Satiated. You're committed to the maintenance of the status quo. The status quo, you know, you'd achieved all these astonishing successes in the space of a decade. You don't want to put those successes at risk. Just want Europe to kind of get used to the new status quo. All right. Germany's satiated. Why is all this stuff of interest to us in this class? How does it relate to the central issues that we're concerned with? Well, what are those central issues? It's the great questions that lie at the heart of this whole field of inquiry, international relations. What are they? It's the fundamental problem of war and peace. What makes for war? Or looking at the issue from the other side, what makes for a stable international system? How does international politics work? And you have this very powerful, very influential argument that says, you want to understand war? You don't have to figure out who the aggressor is. You want to understand war? You look at the system. War is built into the very fabric of international politics, into the very structure of international politics. In a world of sovereign states where there's no authority above the states, you're going to have war. Because in such a world, an anarchic world, everyone has to worry about their own security. To provide for your security, since no one else is going to come to your aid, you have to develop as much power as you can. And that security competition, that competition for power, necessarily puts states at odds with each other. Right? The system puts states on a collision course with each other. That's the Waltz argument. You read it in that article that was assigned first. Is that the way a world of sovereign states works? Is it inherently unstable? Right? Is it prone to war? Waltz says it is. It's sort of that the system is what explains the dismal recurrence of war throughout the millennia. Okay? Is that true? Is it true, therefore, that states or statesmen who accommodate to that logic, who are sensitive to the logic of the system, who respond to the imperatives created by the system, the pressures created by the system, you know, who pursue these kind of realist policies based on power, amoral policies, policies that are rooted in a certain a geopolitical sensibility. Don't moral considerations push to the side. Ideological considerations push to the side. What's really important, you know, for statesmen of that sort, realist statesmen, is the structure of power, right? And enhancing your own power and worrying about how power is distributed in the system as a whole. You know, realist statesmen, practitioners of realpolitik, to use the German term. Uh, Is a world dominated by such statesmen an unstable world? Is it inherently a bad thing for countries to pursue policies of that sort, realist policies, as opposed to kind of policies rooted in a different set of concerns, moral concerns? So you can see how the fundamental theoretical issue here is related to this whole second set of questions that people in this field are concerned with, namely the question of what constitutes a good foreign policy? Are there general principles that you could draw on to guide foreign policy? And in particular, should foreign policy be based on moral concerns? Spreading liberty, spreading democracy, you know, all those kinds of things. Or is it a bad thing to pursue that kind of policy? Is that just a recipe for instability in the world? Is it much better for statesmen to pursue realist policies, shorn of their moral components, policies that are concerned simply with a country's core power political interests? Fundamental question. And so the real issue for us is, given how important those questions are, not just in the interpretation of international politics in the past, but as related to possible guidelines for the conduct of foreign policy in the present and in the future, you know, the issue is, how do you go about getting a handle on them? How do you go about getting insight into them, right? And the premise is, you look at the historical record. And that's why this period that begins in 1871 is so important, so interesting. Because if there is a realist statesman, if there is a statesman who thought, you know, coldly in terms of power and interest, who was a practitioner of realpolitik, who put those realist principles into practice, that realist philosophy into practice, it must have been Otto von Bismarck, the chancellor of the new German Empire. And so we can look at the Bismarck policy, and we could ask, is this stabilizing or destabilizing? Right? And especially in the period after 1871, very different from 1862 on, when he's pushing for very radical change in the status quo, right? And successfully transforms Prussia from the weakest to the strongest of the great powers, in effect, right? 1871 on, that policy is in the past, the policy that looked to a radical change. Now he's a pillar of the status quo. Now Bismarck simply wants to maintain the status quo, right? So this gives additional point to the issue, right? Because even if you're committed to the status quo, is that any guarantee that this kind of policy is going to result in a stable international system? Is it sufficient that the most important power in the system is a status quo power for that system to be a stable system? Or are the systemic forces, the kind of forces that Waltz talks about, so powerful that they overwhelm these desires to maintain the status quo, that they push states into conflict with each other whether they want to or not, right? And it's a fundamental argument in contemporary international relations thought that it's not sufficient that you would be happy to accept the status quo if everyone else were. Right? This is, I'm sure you've all been exposed to this in other classes. You've heard of Robert Jervis, probably, and the whole concept of the security dilemma, which was developed, by the way, when Jervis was an assistant professor here at UCLA. Very important concept, because the basic idea of the security dilemma is that countries are led to pursue aggressive policies for purely defensive purposes. You may be very happy to live with the status quo if you had some sort of guarantee that everyone else would. But since in an anarchic system you don't get that kind of guarantee, you can't pursue a passive policy. passive. You have to be much more active. You have to, you know, be led to pursue what could amount to aggressive policies, even for purely defensive purposes. Because people are trapped by the logic of the situation. They're trapped by the dynamics of the system, right? Important set of arguments. The issue for us is, are those claims correct? Right. So that's why the whole story of what happens after 1871 is of such interest. We know that there was this great war, First World War, that breaks out, 43 years later. Is that war, the First World War, to be attributed to the kind of system that you had, this Europe of five great powers, a system of sovereign states? Is it a result of countries pursuing policies that were rational in terms of the basic structure of the system? Policies that made sense from a power political point of view, that were rational in power political terms? Or is it because countries didn't pursue those kinds of policies, that the kinds of policies they pursued didn't make sense in power political terms? Right? So we began to kind of take a crack at this by looking at one of the key aspects of the settlement of 1871, the German decision to annex these two French provinces, Alsace and Lorraine, full of people who thought of themselves as fully French. Right? That this makes sense in power political terms. And the argument was, no, it didn't. This was not a policy that a pure power politician would have pursued. Why is that? Because, not for moral reasons. This was no worse in moral terms than having Poles in the new German Empire, or having Danes in the new German Empire, as they in fact were. It was important for political reasons, because France is an important country. France would eventually have the second strongest army in Europe in this period before the First World War. Right? You're alienating France. Right? And what's the consequence of alienating France? It makes it very difficult for you to conduct a foreign policy of your own. It makes it very, very hard for you to provide for your own security, because you have to worry about what goes on outside your borders. In this respect, theorists are absolutely correct. Even countries that are perfectly happy to live with the status quo can't pursue purely passive policies and say, oh, we're not going to get involved in international politics until our own borders are crossed. No, because you have to worry about the process by which threats take shape. You have to worry about your power political position in the world, about the possibility that other countries might be ganging up against you. So you have to kind of move preemptively to forestall those threats. You know, it doesn't mean through military action, but through having an active diplomacy, by having an active policy that's rooted in the sense that what matters in the rest of the system is of fundamental importance to you. Okay? So how did the Alsace-Lorraine business affect Germany's position? The key sentence here is one that Sontag quotes in the text that you'll be reading for this week. Is Bismarck's comment that in a Europe of five great powers, the crucial thing was to be one of three, to be a trois in a Europe of five great powers. And he said that was the strategy, the policy of all the cabinets of Europe, and his above all. Because if you're one of three, then you're not really threatened. If you have these two friends who are going to come to your aid, if your position is challenged, you're in quite good shape. And on any political issue, your coalition is going to have the dominant say, because, you know, it's going to be the stronger of the two coalitions. Let me just say in passing that sort of philosophy, if it's spread throughout the system, is a source of stability. Why is that? Because if everyone feels that it's good to have as many friends and as few adversaries as possible, that adversaries are a source of weakness because it means that you're dependent on your friends, that in the case of Bismarck, you know, if being one of three is good, being one of four is even better, because then you're less susceptible to the threat of defection on the part of one of your friends. Right? And if everyone thinks along those terms, and everyone wants to have as many friends as as few enemies as possible, then you can have good relations all around. Right? If that logic was the only factor that affected people's policies, a pure power political system would be relatively stable. In other words, if you factored out substantive conflicts like Alsace-Lorraine or the Austro-Russian rivalry over the Balkans, if you factored all of that out and everything was just a question of maneuver, international politics was to be understood in game-like terms, then it would be fairly stable. Okay, just a digression. How did this Alsace-Lorraine business impact on us? Well, it ruled out a number of possible alignments. Basically, Bismarck had to conduct policy with one hand tied behind his back. Because you say, well, you want to be one of three, but what is that one of three going to be? Germany, Britain, and France? Because France would never join an alignment with Germany. Any alignment with France, out of the question. French will never do it. And so what sorts of choices do you have in terms of your alignments? Well, there's the alignment with the two other Eastern empires, Austria and Russia, three great conservative states in Europe, right? Austria, Russia, and Prussia. And this alignment had a certain ideological content, you know, holding the line against the forces of liberalism, forces of revolution throughout Europe, maintaining the status quo. And in fact, an alignment of this sort came into being after 1871 with what was called the League of the Three Emperors. The German term is often used for this, Dreikaiserbund of 1873. Right? But there's a problem with this alignment. What's the problem? It's that Austria and Russia don't have a genuine community of interest. They have radically different interests when it comes to Southeastern Europe. Russia wants to expand in that area, partly for strategic reasons, because getting the control over the Turkish Straits is a long time Russian goal. Because so much of Russian commerce passes through there. And if you get control of the Turkish Straits, you could prevent foreign powers from coming up into the Black Sea and attacking you, like Britain and France did during the Crimean War. It's an expansion of Russia toward the south, toward the Turkish Straits. This had been a long-term Russian policy. You just look at those maps of Russian expansion in the course of the 18th century, and it continues not just in the 19th century, but in the 20th century as well. After the Second War, there's a big crisis over the Turkish Straits, 1946. Plus, there's the ideological component of Russia's historic mission as the champion of the Slavs against Ottoman misrule. Suppose you're successful with something like that, and you have these Slavic nationalities rising up in Southeastern Europe, you know, backed up by Russian power. Well, how's that going to affect Austria with its very large Slavic populations? How's it going to affect Austria's position if she's going to be surrounded geopolitically by this arc of Russian power, encouraging the Slavic nationalities within the Austrian Empire to demand more autonomy, maybe even full independence? And then that's the end of Austria as a unified state. So Austria has a survival interest in preventing Russia from moving down in that area, in blocking the expansion of Russian power to the south. Right? This is a fundamental clash. And given that there's this fundamental clash, if you have an alignment of Germany, Austria, and Russia, Russia's going to come to Germany and say, look, if you don't back us in our conflict with Austria over southeastern Europe, we're going to defect. We're going to go over to the side of France. This is not a pleasant position for Bismarck to be in. Because, Germany's a strong country, but Germany is not a European hegemon. Germany can't lay down the law to Europe. Germany has to worry about a Franco-Russian alliance and having to fight a war in two fronts. This would be a difficult thing for Germany. Germans want to avoid this, but how are you going to avoid it? We side with Russia against Austria, and that leads to the collapse of Austria, and then you yourself are going to have to deal with this Russian colossus, not just in your east, but your south as well. The eastern alignment, the alignment of the three emperors, this is not a favorable solution in itself for Bismarck. Well, so what's the alternative, given that an alignment with France is ruled out? Well, there's only one viable alternative, and that's an alignment based on the containment of Russian expansion. Because Austria is not the only power that has an interest in containing Russia. The other great power that has that kind of interest is Great Britain. Because Great Britain is not interested in seeing Russia get control over the Turkish Straits. British and Russian interests collide through the entire rim of Asia. Through the Turkish Straits in the west, through what was then Persia, now contemporary Iran, Central Asia, Afghanistan, approaches to India, and then even in China, northeastern China, where the Russians are on the march. Well, maybe you could have an alignment of those three powers, Britain, Germany, Austria, based on the containment of Russia. But there's a big problem here, too. Right? Problem with that kind of alignment. Well, there are two problems. The first problem is, if Germany opts for that sort of policy directed at the containment of Russian power, and Germany lands in a war, not just with Russia, but with France as well. Because if you're writing off Russia, Russia's going to go over to the side of France. Who's going to have to bear the brunt of that fighting? Well, it's going to be Germany, the country with the least direct interest in pursuing anti-Russian policy. The British are going to be in the driver's seat. They're going to determine where to draw the line. But Germany's going to have to do all the fighting. Not a pleasant position. That's problem number one. Problem number two with that sort of alignment is that, can you really trust the British? They've become increasingly democratic in the course of the century. Parliament, based on an electorate composed of a very large chunk of the male population, male adult population, has developed all these powers. And the British government changes back and forth between conservative governments and liberal governments. And conservatives, Bismarck has no problem getting along with conservatives because they tend to think in power political lines. And if he had been certain that conservative governments would remain in power, it would be great. They want to block the expansion of Russia. They want to maintain the status quo in Southeastern Europe. Think of powerful influence. The problem is that every 7 years there's a change of government, and the Liberal Party comes in, and the Liberal Party has a very different philosophy. Liberal Party in Britain has a totally different social base, different geographical base than the conservatives do. They conservatives tend to be based in the south of England. They're Church of England types, relatively well-to-do people. The liberals are lower middle class. They're based in the north of England, not Church of England, what's called nonconformist. In other words, other Protestant denominations. There is this big gap between kind of the two Englands. And the liberals take the view that foreign policy has to be based on moral principle, and especially the right of self-determination. The great leader of the liberals in late 19th century Britain, William Gladstone, was a great proponent of that sort of philosophy. He was a great hero of Woodrow Wilson, for example. And what did this mean? It led the liberal governments to sympathize with the aspirations of these peoples in southeastern Europe that were suffering under the Turkish yoke. And since they tended to be more religious and more sincere about their religiosity, the fact that these were Christian populations being oppressed by a Muslim state was yet another argument for Britain throwing her power in the balance, not on behalf of the maintenance of the status quo in that area, but on behalf of the kind of liberation of these peoples in southeastern Europe. Liberals tend, Gladstone in particular, tends to pursue an anti-Austrian policy because Austria wants to maintain the status quo. And so from Bismarck's point of view, how can you deal with a country like that that can't pursue a consistent power politically based sort of policy? Okay. So what is his solution? What is his solution to his geopolitical problem? The best he could come up with is to balance between those two possible alignments: the conservative alignment of the League of the Three Emperors, Austria, Germany, and Russia, on the one hand, and the alignment based on the containment of Russia, the Austria-Britain-Germany alignment. Right? You don't commit yourself to either alignment. You try and keep your options open, balance between the two, so that you in effect are telling the Russians that we will maintain a certain relationship with you, but if you go too far, you push us too far, and you threaten to go over the side of France, well then, we'll opt for a more overt anti-Russian alliance with Britain and Austria. You try and balance between the two. And there's a certain element of duplicity that's built into the situation. You know, the duplicity is very normal in international politics. Hypocrisy is normal. Dishonesty is normal because it's built into the structure of the situation. Right? You want to tell the Russians one thing, you want to tell the British another thing, you want to tell the Austrians a third thing. You have to do that if you want to maintain your freedom of action. You want to maintain your options, because if you offer one or the other of these alignments, your position is not nearly as strong as it would be as if you try and balance. But balancing between those two blocks, it's a tenuous policy. Right? It's not rock solid. This is an important point for our purposes, because it's not sufficient that Bismarck be committed to the status quo, that the most important power in Europe be committed to the status quo for you to have a stable system. That's one thing. And the other element in this policy is this policy toward France. If you can't make an alignment with France, then what? You want to keep France as weak as possible. Why is that? Because if France is strong, then that would be a standing temptation for some other power in Europe that you want to be on good relations with, namely Russia preeminently, to threaten to go over to the side of France. Because if France is strong, a Franco-Russian bloc would be very strong. Real source of concern for Germany, and therefore a threat on Russia's part to go over to the side of France, would be a powerful threat. It would have a real influence on German policy. You want to forestall that, right? And to forestall that, you want to keep France as weak as possible. The German term for a country that is attractive as an ally is Bundeswehr. Put it up there. It means alliance worthy. You want to keep France from being Bundeswehr. You want to keep France from being attractive as an ally, above all to Russia, but also to the other powers as well. And how are you going to do that? Well, the answer is you use whatever levers are at your disposal to prevent the French from recovering their power, from building up their power. And you do have levers at your disposal. You have this army of occupation in northern France. The army of occupation stays there until the French have paid their indemnity. And you want to basically threaten the French that if they don't behave themselves, if they try and build up their power too much, then you might go to war against them. Then you might use force against them. So this is this period, 1871 to 1875. Bismarck wants to keep France weak. The French, of course, have exactly the opposite calculation. They want their country to be strong. They want their country to be Bundeswehr. They want to recover their power in the system, their freedom of action. They don't want to be totally at the mercy of Germany. Right? And they have this revisionist goal of getting back Alsace-Lorraine. Not necessarily through war, but they look at the whole situation in Europe and they say, sooner or later, Germany is going to get involved in some conflict with Russia over these eastern questions. And when that happens, basically we tell the Germans, you want us to stay neutral in that war, give us back Alsace-Lorraine. And they're quite overt about this sort of thing. The French want to build up their power. They could only play that game if they're a strong country. How can they build up their power? Well, by emulating what the Germans had done. Again, this is a very nice argument that Kenneth Waltz has made about how in the system, states come to resemble each other because what's successful tends to be emulated. Unsuccessful policies, strategies, ways of organizing things tend to be weeded out. The wars of German unification had revealed the phenomenal effectiveness of the German military system, Prussian military system. Yeah. And so the French had these very major military forms, modeling their army now on the Prussian army, which is based on conscription. Not long-term conscripts like you had in the Second Empire, but everyone undergoing military service. And they pursued a vigorous policy of putting their own house in order, raising money in London to pay off the indemnity so as to get the German troops to leave. Right? After some hesitation on Bismarck's part, they pretty much had to leave. They left, right? And getting France's house in order domestically, getting a stable political system in place. And what happened was a republic is put in place in France, quite unexpectedly, almost by accident, because you had these three monarchical parties. You had the Bonapartists, the Legitimists, the champions of the old Bourbon dynasty, and the partisans of the Orleanist dynasty that had ruled France from 1830 to 1848. And they couldn't agree with each other. They couldn't even agree on what sort of flag the new country would have. And so they opted for a republic, as in the words of one of the leading French statesmen of this period, Adolphe Thiers, is the form of government that divides us least. And to everyone's astonishment, this republic is a conservative republic. In those days, people thought that, a republic is bound to be radical. Conservative republic would sound like an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms. But they established this republic. It put down the extreme left, the Paris Commune in 1871. And left in those days was highly nationalistic. The reason for the Paris Commune was resentment over the cession of Alsace-Lorraine. Okay? You have this conservative republic. It wasn't even assumed that this would be a permanent regime. They didn't have a constitution. They had what's called a basic law. But it turns out the Third Republic is the longest lasting of the French republics to date. It lasted until 1940. And Bismarck initially liked the idea of a French Republic because for him it meant that this was yet another barrier to good relations between France and Russia. How could Tsarist Russia ally itself with a republic? Right? But you have this attempt to build up French power, right? Throw off the German oppressive presence, to rehabilitate France as one of the great powers in the system. Okay, and so Bismarck sees this, doesn't like it, because he knows that it's going to sharpen his geopolitical problem once France becomes Bundesfähig. And he resorts to this policy of intimidation. And there's an internal German domestic element that becomes linked up with this. Because Bismarck, in those early years of the German Empire, becomes very fearful of the Catholic element within Germany, and the fact that the Catholics are getting external support. And he conducts a campaign, basically a persecution against the Catholics. Hard to understand because you're trying to forge a unified nation, one third of which is Catholic. So why would you want to alienate the Catholics? Again, these things don't always make sense in rational political terms. But Bismarck thought the Catholics were his enemies within Germany, that they were supported from the outside, from France, from Austria. He saw these international clerical conspiracies. This was yet another element in this policy of trying to intimidate the French. Okay, so how do they do it? You have a lot of talk beginning in military circles. The French are trying to build up their power. Why are they doing this? Well, because they intend to fight another war with Germany. They refuse to accept the fact that Germany has displaced France as the number one power in Europe. They are aiming at reversing the verdict of 1871. Why should we allow them to choose the time and place? The German argument runs. If this is their policy, then war is inevitable. But if war is inevitable, why shouldn't we have that war at a time that suits us? Right? Before matters get totally out of hand. Before France becomes so strong that she's attractive as an ally and gets allies, and maybe we're going to have to fight a war on two fronts against both France and Russia. Why wait? Right? This is the preventive war argument. It's especially strong in military circles. You know, the great hero of the Wars of German Unification, Field Marshal von Moltke, he made this kind of argument. Not just him, just some of Bismarck's key associates in the Foreign Office were quoted in the press as arguing along those lines. And in 1871, all this stuff comes to a head. And these articles appear in the press, and newspapers that are known to have close ties to the German government. Is war in sight? Right? Making these preventive war arguments. Now this is a policy of intimidation. Bismarck, especially the German emperor, have no desire to go to war against France, but they're brandishing the threat of war in order to get the French to behave in a calm way. And so how do the French react? Very cleverly. Their foreign minister, the Duke of Decazes, he kind of basically sees through Bismarck's game. He's a little upset, but he feigns a lot more anxiety than he in fact feels. and appeals to the powers of Europe to come to France's assistance. And this they're willing to do. Because there was a change in government in Britain in 1874. The liberals are out, now the conservatives under Disraeli are back in power. And they intervene, British intervene, and especially the Russians intervene. They put the question to the German authorities in Berlin, are you going to go to war with France? And they get very clear assurances from the emperor. No. Russian Chancellor Gorchakov, personal enemy of Bismarck, he issues this famous communique after he and the Tsar had visited Berlin and had these discussions with the German leaders. He says, the Tsar leaves Berlin convinced that peace is now assured, as though it was the intervention of Russia that had guaranteed peace. Similarly, the British. Disraeli said, looking at what the Germans are doing, he says, well, Bismarck is really an old Bonaparte again. He needs to be bridled. So the British throw their weight in the balance. And so in a sense, Bismarck's bluff is called. Why was it that Russia and Britain intervened like that? For moral reasons? Well, not really. They had a powerful political interest in a relatively strong France as a counterweight to Germany. Right? Because if France were a cipher, they would have relatively little leverage over German policy. But if they could throw their weight to the side of a relatively strong France, well, that would give them influence vis-a-vis Germany. The very fact that led Bismarck to say France should be as weak as possible lead Russia and Britain to say that for their own power political interests, they wanted France to be as strong as possible. And so you had this new equilibrium coming into being. A Europe of five great powers, but France is not a cipher. France is a full member because the other powers are not going to allow French power to sink below a certain level. They have a power political interest in France with a significant amount of military power as a counterweight to Germany. Right? So this is the system. This is not a system of German hegemony. Germany is not a hegemon. Germany might be the number one power in Europe, but just first among equals. The effect of this crisis of 1879 is to strip away the veils and reveal the basic structure of the system. A system not dominated by any single power. A system of sovereign states that are in equilibrium with each other. Okay? All this is important. To digress for a minute. There's a very nice theory in the international relations literature. Actually, it's a book that was written by a historian named Jeffrey Blaney called The Causes of War. And Blaney makes this argument that the only reason you have war is that the countries involved disagree about relative power. They disagree about who's going to win a war. Because both of them agreed they would settle these things without a war. The weak would give way to the strong. So, and he says, but war plays a very basic function in that system because it makes it clear what the real balance of power is. Right? Well, you could say the same sort of thing about crises. Crises play an important role in the international political system because they reveal what the basic structure of power is. So it reveals that German power is limited. This reveals that France is going to be a significant member of the system with French power underwritten to a degree by both Britain and Russia. Okay? That's what determines the basic parameters of the system. And it's important because it means that Bismarck's geopolitical problem, the problem of having to construct an alignment or trying to balance between these two possible alignments, this is going to be more acute. It's going to be sharper than it would have been had French power been repressed. Right? And so that geopolitical problem is going to dominate international politics in the years to come. Right? It's going to lie at the heart of all these complications that we're going to see unfolding. Complications resulting, above all, from the development of this antagonism between Austria and Russia over the Balkans. And we'll see that next time when we look at the Near Eastern crisis of 1875 to 1878.